see the Waters EIP as a huge positive step forward, because look, we have a lot of smaller cattle farms up here, and like I said, the once-off drinking points are a huge issue, and it's great now that there'll be funding there. And I can say, look, if you fence this off, if you put in an alternative drinking source, there will be funding. Again, culverts maybe as well will be huge. Paying lads maybe and ladies for putting in extra buffer zones in critical source areas is another huge one as well. For the smaller farmer that cannot afford to put in these measures up until now, it should have a huge impact, because they're the biggest issues that really we have been coming across.
It's great to be back with another Environment Edge podcast, and you're very welcome to the show, everyone. We have to be really nice to our next guest, Deirdre. We have fellow ASIP advisor, but most importantly, a proud Mayo woman on the show.
With top tips for farmers on better phosphorus utilisation and reduced sediment loss, Chagask ASIP advisor in Mayo, Mary Roach, joins us for a chat.
I'm Cathal Summers.
And I'm Deirdre Glynn,
your Chagask Sustainability Advisors. And you're welcome to another Environment Edge podcast, number 74. And here we go.
Mary, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks a million, Deirdre.
You're a West of Ireland woman like myself, Mary. And I suppose, you know, over the last couple of years, we've been working together on the ASAP programme, working in catchments on water quality. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing and what problems you're encountering over in Mayo at the moment, Mary?
Yeah, no problem, Deirdre. Yes, I'm working up here in Mayo, and my colleague Peter Comer is also. It's quite a large county, and we have a lot of catchments up here and an awful lot of lakes as well as rivers, and a lot going on. I suppose it's the type of land and country we're working with has issues that might be more particular to where we're from compared to, as we would say up here, the good land that ye have down there. So look at maybe one of the more particular things that we come across up this direction is issues regarding phosphorus and sediment also seem to be something that crops up quite a lot when we're out with the catchment scientists, and that we may receive referrals for as regards the fact that phosphorus and sediment are dropping water quality on the farms and along the catchments that we are working on up here, you know.
And sediment is a really big issue, isn't it? Like when we started on the programme a couple of years ago, we would have said, oh yeah, nitrate or phosphate. But actually sediment and the movement of sediment is a big issue on farms.
Yeah, absolutely, Deirdre. And a lot of the referrals we get would be in relation to sediment up this side of the country. And, you know, the funny thing is, even recently, and we've spoken to a huge amount of farmers at Acres courses and even KT discussion groups, and there's a complete lack of awareness of the fact that sediment is having a huge negative impact on water quality. Everybody thinks of the nutrients, but they don't think of sediment. And one thing that I suppose I try and point out to them is, you know, and put it into people's heads to understand that if you sediment, and particularly say if it's a clay particle of sediment, you'll have phosphorus as a nutrient actually locked on there. So I'm trying to get people to understand that even when you have sediment getting in, you also have phosphorus getting in, because the two are kind of interlinked there. And yeah, causing huge detrimental issues with fish spawning beds and quality of water up this side of the country, you know. And I think it's something that once you have an awareness of the fact that it is causing an issue, then we can get people to work on trying to do something about it. But they need the awareness, first of all, that yes, this is one of the bigger problems up where I'm working at the minute.
What's the water quality like in Mayo, Mary? Are you good, bad or indifferent compared to the rest of the country?
Well, you know, we're always great at things up here. Well, like the football, we're always ahead of the curve. You know, the recent EPA water quality report that came out there said that only 54% of surface waters were satisfactory and there was an overall decline in water quality. And look at when I looked at figures for Mayo, look at overall, yes, we are better than that. Like we are better than the national figures because maybe we're not just quite as intensive. We've a lot of hill land and we have areas where there mightn't be so much farming and impacts happening. But at the same time, the trend is there. And that's what I try again to say to farmers. It's not about where you are, it's about where you're going. And very unfortunately, the trend up our side of the country here is also downwards as regards water quality, unfortunately, Cathal. And that's why, like I said, we have a programme like the ASSAT programme to try and just halt that decline as well as trying to restore back what we had as well.
You're after making a real valid point there that we always talk about down here. And because, and you mentioned, we have the real freezing and soils down southeast where we are, and we have a lot of derogation farmers, a lot of intensity down here. And often we kind of forget, and you mentioned that a lot of the Mayo area might not be as intensive, or it might be different type of land, but there's still water quality problems. It might be nitrate problems, but phosphorus is obviously part of the nitrates directive as well, and that's a big one to hit.
It is huge, Cathal. And, you know, again, like I said, if you did look back at that EPA report, in that report, they actually said that in 2022, like a quarter of all rivers exceeded the limit that we need for phosphorus. So like that's a quarter of all the rivers exceeding the amount of phosphorus that will get us to where we need to be, which is that everything being at least good status. So it is a huge problem. And again, look at, because of the soil type that we have up here, we have a heavier type of soil. We have a lot of peat soils as well that just actually won't hold phosphorus. And again, we're trying to get farmers to understand the difference. Like, do you know, a clay soil may hold phosphorus, whereas a peat soil will not. And you have to look and be aware of your soil type and where your losses are occurring on your farms. And, you know, Cathal, even with yourselves down there, and while we might look on you as having a better type of land down there, still you can have a mix on any farm. You could have a good free drain and soil on most of the farms, but you might just then have these one or two fields that are wetter and heavier and more peaty. And while most of the farm might be a problem as regards or a danger area as regards loss of nitrogen, you still could have an issue with phosphorus on these other fields. So awareness of soil type and what you're farming with is absolutely huge.
Mary, earlier you referred to referrals, and I suppose that's the scientific advice that's given to us by the catchment scientists on our programme. So they direct us to whether it's either a diffuse problem or whether it's a point source problem. So in respect to, say, diffuse or point source, what kind of pressures are seen in Mayo currently?
Yeah, well, a lot of the referrals that we receive up here is for what's happening out on land. And again, what's happening out on land a lot is, look at, as regards nutrients. And for us, like I said, again, if you have a heavier type of soil, a peaty type of soil, more waterlogged, saturated type of soils, then the loss there that we're going to see potentially is from phosphorus. Because again, and we try and speak to farmers and explain to them, how do you lose phosphorus? You lose it from overland flow. It's across the surface. It's not like nitrogen, which goes down in a subsurface. So then we see that a danger time of the year is when you're spreading nutrients, like around this time of the year. I mean, if it's going to be across surface flow, then you're losing phosphorus that way, then we have to be very careful with spreading on saturated soils, or if they're frozen or they're snow covered, if plants aren't growing, if we don't abide by buffer zones, if we're going too close to our drains, if the plant isn't actually growing, it's not going to take up the nutrient either. And especially if you're looking at a peaty type of soil, like I said to you before, the peat soils won't hold it. So if the plant isn't growing, where is it going to go? It's going to go in towards the watercourses. Again, we have a lot of smaller, more extensive type of farming up here. But we do find that we have a lot of issues with once-off cattle drinking points and animal access points into drains and that. And that's, again, pushing down sediment. Again, because we're a wetter type of land in some areas, there's always been a historic move to drain land and to try and keep water moving. And so that, again, is another thing that's leading to a lot of losses as regards sediment. And again, like I said before, if you have sediment in a clay soil, you'll have phosphorus locked on. So you have the two issues nearly running together. To be honest, when I'm speaking up here and giving advice, and again, when I'm speaking to the catchment scientists, we can't really in a lot of cases, separate one out from another. If there's an issue with sediment, there's an issue with phosphorus. So, like I said, not all big farms, but it's all about these drainage, once-off drinking points is absolutely huge. Not abiding by buffers, again, watching where you're putting your nutrients.
I suppose abiding by the close period as well, and taking cognizance of when you can actually go out with nutrient, when the soil temperature is right, when the growth rate is up, you know, all of those, the the period then, you know, for grass growth is going to be different down here than it is magic day, as they say, you know, is different down here than it is where you are in Mayo.
It is, Deirdre. And the thing is that we really have to get a message across as well, because like I said to you earlier, like phosphorus, the likes of phosphorus is flowing across land. That's why the buffer zones are so important. And that's why we need people to understand that at these danger times at the beginning of the spreading season and the end, the buffer zones are actually doubled up. Instead of being 5 meters, they go to 10 meters because you need that extra protection at that time of the year, because land is wetter and the plant, of course, is not in some cases fully even growing. Do you know, now it does vary, and it varies from one side of the country to the other. It varies from 1 year to the other as well. But we also have to remember that it's not just this date that we come to in January and say, now it's the open day, it's the beginning of the slurry spreading season. Not necessarily. It's only the beginning if the conditions are right, if it's not raining, if there isn't heavy rain forecast, if it's not frozen, like, and you have to watch what you're putting out and watch your buffer zone. So it's always very conditional. It's not just now is the day, it's open season, I can go. You have to check that everything else is right as well, so you're going to minimise any losses at all to waters.
Mary, you've a big interest in behavioural change, and you've studied it here in Chagask. Can you tell us, like, the farmers, is it difficult to get that message across with spreading dates, spreading times, keeping out with the buffers? You know, do you think it's a difficult message to get across and get this behavioural change?
Well, what I found, Deirdre, is over the years that a lot of it is the farmers need to get the message as to why. Why do we need a buffer zone? Why is there a closed time of the year? And not even just farmers, but I would say definitely a huge part of that too is the actual contractors, because we have a lot of contractors up here to do a huge amount of work for farmers. And myself and Peter Comer would have had information meetings for contractors in recent years, because we see how much work they do on farm, and a lot of farmers rely on them too. But I do find people are any farmer you talk to wants good water, and nobody wants to be detrimental to water. But really, up till a certain point, a lot of them just used to hear about regulation. This is the regulation. Well, you must abide by the regulation. But maybe the message hadn't gone to them. Why is that regulation written that way? Why? What is the importance of buffer zones? Now, if I go out talking to them and say, look, phosphorus goes across the surface, that's why you need the buffer zone. It's to stop the phosphorus getting in. Then you see it's like light bulb moment. This is the first time we heard this. We just knew we had to have a buffer zone. We didn't know why. It's same with the close time. All the scientific evidence that the Chagas calves is that the riskiest time for losses are during when that close time is. So it's totally backing up the protection measures that are there for water courses. And I just think it's hugely important that when you're asking someone to change their behaviour, you don't dictate, but you explain to them the reason why you want them to. And any logical person then, when they are explained to that way, then yes, they'll work that way. Now, I do know, and I can't say that there isn't issues as regards some farms may need to get extra slurry storage, and they may be a bit tight on storage. And in cases like that, you know, they're not making the best choice for water quality, because there may be slurry coming up close to their slats, and what are they to do? And I have to acknowledge that as well. They may have adequate for the regulation, but some years we get wetter and wetter coming out of the winter, and you can have a very long season, and it's hard to manage. So if, like I said, adequate storage and having a little bit extra would give a lot more choice to farmers on the ground as well as to controlling what they can do and when they can do it.
The best example of that, Mary, was this year our program manager for us, of Noel Meehan, on the Signpost Series, did you see the example he gave? And your colleague, Peter Comer, our ASAP colleague as well. Can you tell the listeners about that example that was given the slurry spread there in just after the open period?
Yeah, I mean, it was an excellent talk by Noel, and he had this, and I always think pictures tell 1,000 words, but he put up a picture of a field where slurry had been spread. Now, look, we all knew there was a river at the edge of the field. You looked and you saw, right, this is fine. And, you know, had they abided by the buffers, I couldn't see clearly off the picture. But nevertheless, what happened is, obviously, we get these weather events, and there was a huge flood of water came into that river, and that river flooded right up the field. It could have been 2 or 3 weeks after. So, like, that is a huge issue. And again, just because you mentioned it there, Cathal, I'll say that for us now in our job, we would call that a critical source area. And this is one thing that I think another message that we clearly need farmers to understand. Well, they do know. I mean, if I go out and I say to a farmer, where's your wettest field, or where's the field that floods? They'll know. We're calling it a critical source area, but they know themselves. And so we have to work with their language. But you have to understand, if you have a field that floods, then you need extra caution in these fields. It's what we call a critical source area. Catchments.ie have maps that everyone or anybody can go in and look. And it'll show you every field and every farm, what area is most vulnerable for losses. And it'll even show you the flow paths. And look, I have printed out these maps and gone out on ground afterwards, and these maps are extremely accurate. They will show you that if there was a flood, which way the water will run across the land. And so, again, like I said, we need extra caution in these areas that we call critical source areas, because these are the areas most prone to loss. And if we put extra caution in these areas, then I think you achieve a whole lot, rather than putting a measure somewhere that it mightn't be just as effective. Because again, when it comes to the likes of phosphorus or sediment or this, our way of controlling that is breaking the pathway. And so we've got to target where the losses are happening.
And good news on that, the Nutrient NMP Online, our Chagas system. So they have an upgrade now where that you can actually do all those maps, all those pollution impact potential maps, the overland flow maps. So if you're in with your local friendly Chagas advisor, just when doing your nutrient management plan, just ask them, I suppose, to print out a few maps for you as well.
Yeah, that's a great facility to have. And again, I will say when the acres scheme was being drawn up, they would have asked as well within the acre scheme that PIP maps, in other words, what we call pollution impact potential maps for phosphorus and this, were used so that advisors will put the right measure in the right place for farmers to get the maximum result. So you would look at your PIP maps, and if it was risky for phosphorus loss, that is the place that the department wanted the riparian buffer margins to go in. So again, it's about matching up the proper measure into the proper place to get the best effect.
Mary, I moved to Kilkenny about 20 years ago or thereabouts, and I suppose when I was living in the West, we would have seen an awful lot of, say, outwintering of cattle. And I suppose down where I am now, people would be outwintering cattle and on forage crops. And how can we manage that situation over a winter period to try and minimise the losses of phosphorus and sediment water bodies?
And look, that still is a common enough practice, to be honest, which even up here. Look, you will have a certain amount out wintering, and some people that don't have sheds, that is just what they do. And so, look, we have to be very clear. And look, there is a lot of regulation around this area as well. And look, regulation in itself would say sacrifice paddocks are out. There absolutely cannot be happening where you put a whole lot of animals into a small area that blacken the field. Because what's happening there is you've nothing when it rains to hold on to that sediment. And again, as I say, I put the two together, sediment and phosphorus will run off that field. And so you're not allowed to have a sacrifice paddock, or indeed severe poaching also would be something similar. Now, obviously, if you're going to have cattle outwintered, you're going to have to be supplementary feeding them. And so again, you have to think, where am I going to site these supplementary feeding points? I mean, you must keep them 20 metres back from your waters so that you're, again, minimising any risk of any runoff getting in towards your waters. You should also be rotating around your supplementary feeding points so no one point is causing excess damage over the complete winter. Now, forage crops, again, these are non-grass forage crops, and these would actually be grazed in situ. And again, look at, if there's a water course there, then you must have a 4 meter buffer strip. And I think that's clearly a way of trying to protect, again, from any sort of sediment or any runoff getting into the waters. So remember that, farmers, like if it's grazed in situ, if you have rape, you have kale, any of that, like 4 meter of a buffer strip is what's needed. And again, you should have a lie back as well for your animals so that, you know, they're not going to be standing in this one area all the time. They'll walk away from where you'd hope water courses or drains were, walk back to a dry lie back area. Again, it's all about trying to minimize any bit of damage or anything getting into the actual water courses. So yeah, it's a danger time of the year. Again, there is a stock and rate requirement there that the department has. So farmers should abide by that stock and rate. Animals shouldn't be all, like I said, in one small area. They should have access to a wide open area. It used to be one livestock unit per hectare. It's now, I think they say, 85 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare of a stocking rate. But again, the farmers should just speak to their advisor and see, tell them how many animals they're thinking about wintering. And again, how much access of land they need for them. And
Mary, do farmers sometimes forget that drains are drains as dangerous as a watercourse? I suppose stuff run. You know, if you have one of them sacrifice paddocks are out wintering and a drain run down the bottom of the field, a land drain.
Yeah, absolutely, Cahill. I'm afraid it was a common misconception up here that the two things were drastically different and that really the water course was the one that you had to protect and keep back from slurry, pesticides, everything else. But the drain was never seen as having a huge problem. But look, as we know up here, there's some catchments up here get over 2 meters of rain annually. So is there such a thing as a dry drain when it comes to it? Look, if it rains, they're all wet, they're all carrying water, and they all have the same potential as a watercourse to carry phosphorus, sediment, pesticides, whatever it is. So really, you've got to treat them the same, Cahill. Look, all drains will eventually lead towards a watercourse, and that's a fact. That's why they're there. And again, like I said, they have to be treated as a watercourse, really, to be honest with you, in the care you have around them. And again, look at that would lead to even the fact that people want to open drains and carry out drainage works. Like often that happens in what farmers would call dry land drains, and that can lead to huge sediment runoff. And one thing I always want farmers to be aware of is, if someone says to me, I'm thinking of doing some drainage, my first question is, why do you really need to do it? Why are you doing this? Are you doing it out of habit? And then I have to ask, what you're thinking of draining, is it a water course or is it a drain? Because they need that awareness of what they're doing as well. Because if you cannot go in and interfere with a water course without permission from Inland Fisheries Ireland, because they are the regulatory body over water courses. So farmers need to get this all clear in their head. What are they dealing with? But why they're dealing, why, if they are intent on doing drainage, then they must do it in a way that's going to minimise the losses of sediment into any watercourses as well, Cahill, do you know?
And I suppose if you are cleaning a drain, Mary, would you, any tips for farmers out there? I suppose you mentioned a big flush of sediment when you were doing drainage works. If you have a drain there that needs to be cleaned, it's choking up and blocking your culverts or whatever. Any tips to help farmers reduce, I suppose, impacts in the river?
Yeah, well, if they are hell-bent on doing the drain, and what we will say to them is, do it in a way that will cause the least amount of impact, okay? Now, a lot of these things are things the farmers mightn't necessarily want to hear, or the contractor either. And again, like I said, contractor is key in this jigsaw puzzle that we have of water quality, I think. Sediment traps should be put in. I mean, we ideally would hope that they'd leave the last 20 metres of the drain untouched and just leave it, you know, If you are going to clean a drain, you start at the upper regions of it and work your way down. You don't start down where the water course is and work your way up and the sediment is coming down against you the whole time. You start at the top, you work your way down. Ideally, you leave the last 20 metres untouched, and then that will sit there and trap sediment and slow down the flow and let things settle out. Look at some farmers will put in a bale of straw or something also, you know, maybe to just try and catch and trap sediment. So it's all about trying to stop the sediment getting in. You really shouldn't be over cleaning drains either. And for biodiversity, look at, there's a huge amount of other things going on, bar water quality. Look at one side of the drain only in a given season should be cleaned. And if you're lifting the spoil off, when you're lifting the spoil out of this, these are farm dry drains as they're known on farm, that spoil should be placed back into the field. So you have a buffer still to stop it running back again into the drain. I've seen work carried out where the spoil is heaped right on the edge of the drain, and the next thing you get a team of rain and it's back into the drain again, a whole flush of sediment. So we need to avoid that. You need to put it back. Like I said, one side in a given year only. Don't overclean them. Don't make them too deep and wide. And again, ideally, look at the months of July to September are the time. So you're causing the least amount of impact as regards possibility of any interference with spawning beds or anything like that as well. So just to think about that time of the year. And one thing we've come across, myself and my colleague Peter Comer up here, is there's a lot of field drains being put in where they're stone filled. And we're coming across a lot of these drains with stone filled right up to the surface. Now, that in itself is no good for water quality. If someone's going out and think they can either spray, spread fertilizer, soiled water, anything. If it's stone right up to the surface, that's treated as an open drain, and farmers need to be aware of that. And, you know, you then have to abide by all the buffer zones, similar to you would a wide open drain. Really, look at, there should be a covering of clay and soil put back over them. The stone should not be brought to the surface, and that will act as a filter, and it'll filter product and nutrients, and it'll avoid anything getting into the water courses.
That might be something farmers aren't massively cognizant of.
No, they're not, Deirdre. And like, we come across it time and time again. And it's just, again, it's something that they believe that the stone must come to the surface. And again, the contractors, because this is the way they've always done it, basically. Yeah. But the awareness wasn't there, the fact that water quality is getting a huge hit if you have a lot of these in the field and you are just spreading your nutrients, same as always, over and back or on them. You just can't do it. So look, it's just a change in behaviour we want there when a person is draining. And for that message to get out, you cannot, if you bring the stone to the surface, that then must be treated as an open drain as regards the regulation for keeping back with fertiliser sprays and everything else that you do.
Would the Waters EIP be able to assist you going forward in putting some of these mitigation strategies in place, Mary?
Oh yeah, Deirdre, I see the Waters EIP as a huge positive step forward, because look, we have a lot of smaller cattle farms up here, and like I said, the once-off drinking points are a huge issue, and it's great now that there'll be funding there, and I can say, look, if you fence this off, if you put in an alternative drinking source, there will be funding. Again, culverts maybe as well will be huge. Paying lads maybe and ladies for putting in extra buffer zones in critical source areas is another huge one as well. I can see there's going to be huge for the smaller farmer that cannot afford to put in these measures up until now. It should have a huge impact, because they're the biggest issues that really we have been coming across up this side, Deirdre.
And hopefully the knock-on will be an improvement in water quality, further water quality.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think even the drainage issue, I think the fact that they may be rewarded for leaving the last section untouched, like that's a huge one too for farmers.
Mary, it sounds like you're giving a lot of very, very good advice up there in Mayo, and keep up the good work. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens up there as regards with the Waters EIP, because I think, like you said, it's going to make a big, big difference. So the very best of luck in your work, and thanks a million for joining us on the show today.
Thanks, Cathal. Thank you, Deirdre.
So there you have it. Tune in next time to hear top tips on how to better utilise nitrogen use on farms and reduce nitrate leaching with Tierlan ASAP Advisor, Matthew Moylan.
Myself and Deirdre will be back in 2 weeks' time, but don't forget to review us on Apple and Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks for listening to the Environment Edge podcast.